The following podcast is for information purposes only and should not be considered as a substitute for psychotherapy with a trained mental health professional.
Rational Radio.
Welcome to Rational Radio. This is Micah Perkins. Today we're going to talk about the different types of thinking. You'll be able to distinguish between inferences and evaluations. We're also going to talk about the four different types of irrational beliefs. All right, let's get started. My name is Micah Perkins. I'm your host. This is Rational Radio. You're learning more and more how to become rational in an irrational world. It is a beautiful, beautiful sunny day here in Oklahoma City. It's about 70 degrees, wonderful outside. I'm looking out my window, doing this podcast for you today. I want to talk today about inferences versus evaluations. We're going to talk about this first. RBT makes a distinct difference between inferences and evaluations, and this is one of the things that sets RBT apart from other cognitive theories. Inferences are conclusions drawn from our perceptions of reality. They're hunches that go beyond the data. So let me give you just a brief example. This morning I was sitting on the couch drinking my cup of coffee, watched this commercial. I'd never seen it before. I believe it's by Singular Wireless cell phones. If not, I apologize. But it went something like this. This guy picks up his cell phone. He calls his girlfriend. Says, "Hey, baby, how you doing?" She says, "Fine." She says, "Why'd you call me?" "Because I miss you. I just want you to know that you're the only woman for me." And then she gets cut off. But he doesn't know that she's cut off, so he's there on the other end waiting for her to say something back. And he doesn't hear anything. So then he says, "Baby, why are you being so quiet? You know you're the only person for me. I'm the only person for you, right? Right? Are you seeing somebody else? You're seeing Fred, aren't you? You're seeing him. So what's wrong? You don't want to talk to me because you're there with Fred? Is that what it is?" And so then, of course, the commercial goes along and talks about how with this particular cell phone company, you won't get cut off. So that's a good example of an inference. He took a little bit of information and jumped to a conclusion. He made an assumption based upon the little bit of information that he had. And for him, it was a negative assumption. Because she was being quiet, then he assumed that she was there with somebody else. He assumed that she didn't have those same feelings for him that he had for her. And then he made another assumption and said that it must be Fred that she's with because, I don't know, maybe Fred had given her some attention or something like that, whatever. But that's a good example of how we take a little bit of data and then we make an assumption, an inference based upon that data. So that's an example of an inference. Now, our inference, our assumptions about present situations are highly influenced by our past experiences, or at the very least, by our interpretations of our past experiences. I said that I had just come back from New York City. While I was there, in Times Square, I went to the Toys R Us. My son is just turned 3. I wanted to pick up a toy for him. Picked up a couple of little Bob the Builder toys for him. He loves cars, trucks, bulldozers. So I come home. Well, to the hotel, call him on the phone, talk to him, how are things going? And I tell him, I said, "Daddy's going to bring you home a surprise." And it's interesting because his next question was, "Is it a car?" And I said, "Well, it's a surprise, you'll just have to see." And so that's an example of how my son, even at 3, he made an assumption, he made an inference. I simply told him, "I have a surprise for you." He then inferred that the surprise would be a car. Now, that's based probably upon a lot of his past experiences. He likes cars. Whenever my wife and I get him presents, a lot of times we get him cars and trucks. We reinforce that idea because he likes them so much. And so then, whenever we say we're going to give you a gift, then he assumes that it's going to be a car. And so I have a feeling that in his little mind, he felt hopeful and excited because he's thinking that it might be a car. So that's an example of how an inference can be a positive thing for us. But, as I said before, like with the cell phone commercial, it can also be a negative thing as well. So negative and inaccurate inferences often contribute to poor mental health. RBT therapists will often try to help their client to be able to evaluate their inferences, to modify those, to correct those, and to make those more realistic. But RBT holds it's not the inferences that are really the core of psychological problems. It's really evaluations that are at the core. And so now let's talk about evaluations. What evaluations are is that they rate the inference. They give weight to the inference. Evaluations are rational or irrational beliefs. As we talked in the last podcast briefly, rational beliefs are preferences, wishes, likes. They're flexible, non-extreme, consistent with reality, and they help the person in pursuing his or her basic goals. Irrational beliefs are rigid or extreme, inconsistent with reality, illogical, and detrimental to the individual in pursuing his or her basic goals. So then let's go back again to the cell phone commercial. He calls her, "Hi baby, I love you, I miss you. Hi, why did you call me? I just wanted to call and tell you that you're the only one for me." And then she gets quiet. So then he makes the inference that you don't think the same way that I do. Now of course that's not correct, because the cell phone had cut off. She couldn't hear him anymore. She couldn't respond. But then what an evaluation would be then is to add weight to that assumption. Because you don't think the same way that I do, then that's awful, that's terrible, that's the worst thing ever, I can't stand it. Without you, I'd be a horrible, rotten, worthless person. You must feel the same way that I do. That then is irrational belief. A rational belief then would be, I wish that you felt the same way that I do, but if you don't, too bad. I'm sad about it, but I can't make you feel the same way that I do. That would be a more rational belief. So now let's talk about the four different types of irrational beliefs. Briefly, to give you a little bit of history about irrational beliefs, when Ellis first presented his paper on RBT in 1956 at the American Psychological Association's convention, he listed 12 common irrational beliefs, and he came up with these during his practice with clients. He noticed that they held irrational beliefs that contributed to their disturbance, and so he just write them down, and he came up with a list of 12, and that's what he presented. And many of the literature, some of the older books, maybe even more contemporary books, you'll often see those 12 listed. For example, in my graduate studies, which wasn't too long ago now, I guess about 10, 12 years ago, it listed these 12 common irrational beliefs. Ellis stated that he had gone on to list more and more irrational beliefs and eventually came up with 50 common irrational beliefs. He started listing more and realized that there's just scores and scores of irrational beliefs that people can hold. So the list is probably limitless. So then he started narrowing down his list and looking for commonalities among them. And what he has now determined is that all irrational beliefs consist of a demand and at least one of three different types of derivatives, what he calls awfulizing, low frustration tolerance, or people rating. Nottingham, in his book, It's Not As Bad As It Seems, calls these the big four. But when we look at, first of all, a demand is a must, should, ought, have to. It's a godlike command that things must be different than how they are. There are often unrealistic expectations of the way things should be, must be. Ellis has been quoted as saying that the road to hell is paved with unrealistic expectations. And so these are the demands, the commands that things must be different. One of the things that Ellis has stated is that people often have healthy, strong desires and values. However, it's easy for us as humans to raise these strong desires and preferences to absolute must, shoulds, demands, and necessities. So, for example, since I strongly prefer something, then it absolutely must be. And it's difficult, Dryden has stated, is that it's difficult for human beings to think only rational whenever they have a really strong desire. So just as human beings in general, we have a tendency to take our healthy desires strong desires and then to push them over into demands, absolute musts. So Ellis has stated that there's three different types of musts. There's self-demanding, I must do something or be a certain way, accomplish something. Other demandingness, you must or they must be a certain way. Or world demandingness, the world, life situations in general must be a certain way. So that is really at the core, the demanding is at the core of every irrational belief. Now we're going to talk about the three derivatives go along with that. First is low frustration tolerance, or what has been called I can't stand itists. And I can't stand itis consists of the idea that I can't stand the discomfort of a situation. Nottingham has stated that this is often associated with overeating, abusing alcohol and drugs, procrastination. I absolutely can't stand for something to happen. Awfulizing is the belief that something is totally bad. It's as bad as it possibly could be, and it's not at all beneficial. It's 100% bad. It could not possibly be any worse. Now, a lot of bad things happen in life. One of the most recent things I can think of from watching the news is what has happened in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, with the person that went into the schoolhouse there, the Amish schoolhouse, and shot, I believe it's 5, 6 of those little girls in that schoolhouse. Obviously, that's a bad thing. And people can go around and walk around and say, that's awful, that's terrible. And again, as I mentioned last podcast, we don't want to get caught up in the semantics of it. Just because somebody says that something is awful or terrible doesn't necessarily mean that they're awfulizing. It just means that they're saying that's a really bad thing. And yes, of course, that's a really bad thing to happen. But what RABT believes is that something cannot be 100% bad. It could always be worse. So, in this context, using RABT language, nothing is ever awful, meaning 100% bad couldn't possibly be worse. There are many, many bad things that happen, but nothing is ever completely bad that cannot be any worse. In this context, yes, it was bad that these children were killed, of course, but it could be worse. What if instead of shooting, and I'm not sure about the number, but 5 or 6 of these little girls, what if he hadn't let out the other children? What if he would have shot all, let's say, 25 that were in there? Then that would be worse than what is now. Let's say that he went to a bigger school and shot 200 kids, and 200 kids died. Then that would be worse. What if instead of shooting the kids, he did some other horrible way of killing them, you know, let's say, you know, stabbing them, skinning alive people, and I don't mean to just, you know, get to be really gruesome, but the thing is that things could always be worse than what they are. And one of the ways when we look at RABT as an art is, of course, you never want to just tell somebody coldly who's sitting there in your therapy session, who's talking about their own past abuse or something like that. You don't want to tell them, well, yeah, you know what, it could be worse. People, rightly so, probably won't respond well to that. So there's a real art to exploring, could it possibly be worse? Yes, this is bad, but is there a way that we can, instead of focusing on the badness of it, focus on the other positive things that are in the situation? I was doing a therapy session with, this was several years ago, with this family. And this man's family, the little girl had been sexually molested by somebody outside the family. She comes home, and what's often the case in that confusion of being sexually molested, she starts sexually acting out with younger siblings in her family. The younger siblings then starts sexually out with other people at their school. Bad situation. Very bad. This man's wife was becoming increasingly frustrated and at one point told him that you better help things, fix it, or I'm leaving you. Bad situation. And so at that point, to sit there and say, hey, you know what, it could be worse, would not be helpful to this guy. But one of the things that we started looking at and exploring is, yes, this is a bad situation, but what are some good things? I know it's hard to see right now, but what are some good things that are going on in life? And even if a person can't find a good thing in a particular situation, usually there's still good things in life. It's very hard to see a lot of times, and of course, people who end up committing suicide, oftentimes they don't see any good things in life, and people who are severely depressed don't see any good things in life. But just because people can't see them doesn't mean that they aren't there. So he at first, as a lot of people do, was really resistant to that whole idea. A couple weeks later, we were sitting and we were talking, and he said, you know, this is bad. What happened was really, really bad. But one thing that has become a more positive thing out of this situation is that we are now closer as a family. Before, I used to go to work, come home, sit there on the couch for a couple hours, watch TV, go to bed. I didn't really interact with my family at all. He said, now that we've had this crisis, we are now spending more time talking to each other. I've learned that I need to be to build stronger relationships with my children. So we now do fun things together. I am now working on building on that positive relationship with them. And if nothing else, I can say at least we're closer now as a family than we ever were before. So in that instance, he had been able to forgive his child for her sexually acting out, forgive his other children for what they had done. He had grown closer to his wife, grown closer to his children, and he had concluded, of course he didn't use this language, is that things were bad, but they weren't awful. They weren't the worst thing ever, that actually some positive things had come out of the situation. And we'll talk more about how to look at these ideas and challenge these ideas in future podcasts. But the last one, we've talked about demanding, low frustration tolerance, awfulizing. Last one we want to talk about is people rating. People rating is overgeneralization, basing a person's worth upon what he or she does. And admittedly, people are, Ellis argues, probably biologically prone. We're also socially conditioned to rate ourselves and rate other people. You think about whenever a child does something good, what are we, at least in this culture, prone to say? Good boy. Good girl. And so rather than saying, what you did was good, we say, because you did a good thing, that makes you a good person. Because you did a bad thing, that makes you a bad person. Practically all people accept themselves conditionally. Because I perform a task well, that makes me a good person. If I fail at a task, or especially if I keep failing at a task or several tasks, then that makes me a complete loser, a worthless, no good person. So we make that jump naturally from what I do. If I do something good, we make the jump to that makes me a good person. Because I do something bad, we make the jump to that makes me a bad person. Now the thing is that even though basing our worth, giving ourselves what Ellis calls conditional self-acceptance, my worth is dependent upon what I do, it can be helpful in the short term. It can propel a person to do good things now. If a person believes that if I fail, that makes me a bad person, then they may spend more time studying for their tests in order to not fail the test because they're trying to protect their sense of self-worth. So in the short term, it can be beneficial for a person. But in the long term, it's often not. Because we are fallible human beings, we will often fail at things. And so if a person holds this belief that my worth is dependent upon what I do, then when they fail, not if, but when they fail, then they'll start seeing themselves as that makes me no good person because I failed at that. And they'll thus, if they have that type of belief, that will then contribute to feelings of depression. Also on the flip side, even if a person is doing well at the time, they have this belief that what I do determines my worth. And even if right now they're at the top of their game, they are doing well, then oftentimes there's this low-level anxiety that I must continue to do well And if I don't, if I do fail at something, that will make me worthless. And because there's this low-level anxiety, they'll push themselves and push themselves and push themselves. And often they push themselves to the point that it's not physically healthy for themselves. Often it's not healthy in their relationships. If they do that, they're spending, you know, all this time at the office because they must succeed at work. But yet, they come home and they're spending little time with their family or with their wife. And so that hurts the relationship. Or the flip side of that is that the person doesn't even try at all. If they believe that I absolutely must succeed, and if not, that makes me a horrible, rotten person, then I'm not going to even try at all. I'm not going to even risk trying to do it, because what if I did fail? That would make me a rotten person. Often it's very easy if a person has conditional self-acceptance, my worth as a person is based upon what I do, then oftentimes they'll judge other people by that same standard. Other people's worth is based upon what they do. So therefore, with their own spouse, you must do well, and if you don't, that makes you worthless. Or with their own children, you must do well, or if you don't, that makes you worthless. And so that, in that sense, also, it's not good in relationships. So when we look at people rating, there's some terms that are synonymous with that. First of all, as I said before, conditional self-acceptance, which is basically the same as people rating, is that I accept myself on the condition that I must perform well and earn the approval of other people in my life. So what RBT strives to do is teach people unconditional self-acceptance. Unconditional self-acceptance says that my behaviors are separate from me, that I may do good things, and that's good. Whenever I do good things, I often get good consequences for that. I may do bad things, and that's bad, because whenever I do bad things, I often get bad consequences about that. But that what I do does not determine my worth as a person. If I do a bad thing, that doesn't make me a bad person. It just makes me a person that did a bad thing. If I do a good thing, that doesn't make me this great, wonderful, fantastic person. It just means I'm a person that did a good thing. So I'm going to, as I continue to try to find unconditional self-acceptance, I'm just going to quote Ellis here. And this is from his book, Feeling Better, Getting Better, Staying Better. And he says, unconditional self-acceptance means that you fully accept yourself, even when you perform badly and may be despised by significant others. You accept yourself just because you're alive, human, and unique. You exist, therefore you're an okay person. Or, in the more elegant rational emotive behavior therapy version, you refuse to give yourself, your personality, your being, any global rating at all. So when we look at learning unconditional self-acceptance, there's two options. We can either accept ourselves as being valuable just because we exist, we're alive, we're a child of God, however you want to look at it. We have value just because we exist. Our value is not based upon anything that we do or don't do. That's one option. Or the other option is that I refuse to give myself a value at all. Now, I rate my behaviors as being good or bad, but I don't rate my personhood as being good or bad. I can even rate characteristics about myself as being good or bad. I can say, my nose is too big, and that's bad. I'm overweight, and that's bad. I can rate those things, but that me, my person, I don't rate at all. Now, also, when we look at rating people, we also look at conditional other acceptance or unconditional other acceptance. And again, conditional other acceptance is you rate the people, their worth, their value, based upon what they do. Unconditional other acceptance means that you accept them, their personhood, not their behaviors, their personhood, just because they exist. And again, I'm going to quote Ellis here. He says, unconditional other acceptance, you accept them as you do yourself, just because they are alive, are human, and are unique. You accept the sinner, but not their sins. You accept the social reality that they are all, every single one of them, incredibly fallible. And you accept them with their failings. Preferably, you only rate or evaluate in terms of your goals and purposes and those of the group in which you reside. The goodness or badness of people's thinking, feeling, and acting and not to rate, and not of themselves or their being. So you may rate a person's actions, their attributes, but you don't rate them as people. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood in this. Just because you accept somebody, their personhood, that they are fallible human beings, and that you either use the one option and say that they have value just because they exist, or you do the other option and say, I refuse to rate the person at all. I'll rate their behaviors, but I don't want to rate the person. Just because you do that, you work on unconditional other acceptance, doesn't mean that you have to say that that means I need to be around them all the time. There are times when, with friends, marriages, relationships, whatever it is, that for whatever reason, it doesn't work. There's the behaviors of a person, they do it over and over again. They say they'll stop doing it. They don't stop. There may be a time when you say, hey, I don't want to be in this relationship anymore. A person can still do that and say, I'm ending this relationship. I value you as a person. I'm not saying that you are a rotten individual. I don't like what you're doing. What you're doing is pretty rotten. But I'm not saying that you're a rotten person. But because that you continue to do these certain behaviors, I'm choosing to end the relationship. That's okay to do, and there may be, unfortunately, very painful times when that might be necessary. So just because we accept other people unconditionally doesn't mean that they have to always be in our lives. That's not what that's saying. That's just saying that I refuse to look at this person as being a no-good, slug, horrible, rotten, terrible person because of what they've done. Oftentimes, whenever we think that people are no-good, terrible, rotten people, that contributes to us doing behaviors that aren't necessarily in our best interest. We may do things that later on that we regret, wish that we hadn't have done. So again, I want to emphasize the point that just because I work on accepting another person unconditionally doesn't mean that they have to always be in my life. That's not true. There's some times when we just have to make that tough decision and choose to end that relationship. So just in summary, we talked about inferences and evaluations. Inferences are those assumptions that we come to. Evaluations add weight. They rate the inference. When we look at evaluations, we're basically talking about rational and irrational beliefs. And the four different types of irrational beliefs are demanding, I can't stand itis, or also called low frustration tolerance, awfulizing, and people rating. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I really enjoyed it. In a future podcast, we're going to talk about how to find out these irrational beliefs. We're also going to talk in the next podcast about the ABC model of REBT and how to plug these things into the ABC model. And then we're going to start talking about how to dispute, how to challenge and work against these irrational beliefs. Thank you for joining me today. I know this podcast was slightly longer than ones have been in the past, but I believe that this was really important information to try to squeeze in together in one podcast. Thanks a lot. I'll see you next time.